Hello and welcome to Film Weekly. I'm Jason Solomons. On this week's show, we examine political evil. Peter Capaldi, the man behind the monstrous spin doctor Malcolm Tucker from In the Loop, reveals all about modern politics, while Viggo Mortensen and I discuss the concept of a decent man caught up in the fervour of Nazism in new film Good. Zan Brooks will be in to review those films, plus the new bromantic comedy I Love You Man. More fun than a torrent of insults from a New Labour blogger, it's Film Weekly. But first on Film Weekly, some very sad news as we report the death of producer Simon Channing Williams, who passed away on Easter Saturday at the age of 63 after a long battle with cancer. Simon was the producing partner of director Mike Leigh, the man who enabled many of his greatest hits, including Happy Go Lucky, Topsy Turvy, Vera Drake, and of course, Secrets and Lies.
You're so selfish, Monica. You might not have wanted them, but he did.
Shut up, ma'am.
You don't know what you're talking about.
Don't I?
There are things you know nothing about.
Morris.
Like what?
Tell her.
Tell me what?
Why can't you tell her? She can't have kids. Simple as that. She's physically incapable of having children. We've had every test known to medical science. She's been pushed around, prodded, poked, had operations, we've had 15 years of it, and she can't have a baby. I love you to bits. But it's almost destroyed our relationship. And you know it has.
And the director of that film, Secrets and Lies, produced by Simon Channing Williams, Mike Leigh, joins me on the line now. Mike, my commiserations to you on the departure of a much-loved friend.
Well, you know, Simon was just, first of all, a great guy, a generous, a huge man physically, you know, and a great personality and a great, you know, he was an enabler. He saw his function in the world to make things happen for people. So, as a producer, he was, I mean, we go back 30 years, actually, and he saw his job as to make space for me to be completely free and creative and do my weird thing, you know. Yeah. And so he could get out there and raise the money and then not only that, but keep the backers away and create the space, not interfere in the wrong way, but just be very supportive. And nothing was impossible.
Yeah,
anything you wanted, he would make it happen.
That's key to your work, isn't it, Mike? Because, I mean, often Simon was going out there trying to raise money, as you say, for films that didn't have a title, that you wouldn't tell them what they were about, they wouldn't tell anyone who was in it. That's one of the hardest producing jobs in the world,
totally.
I think.
I mean, not only the title, no script, and no interference with casting, you know. And he was just brilliant at making that happen and knowing and being really good at negotiating and talking to people, but he also understood film. You know, I mean, he was you know, his knowledge and understanding of the technicalities of film and the organisational needs of film. He was a great lateral thinker as well. Because I first worked with him, he was the first assistant director, which is the person that really, you know, runs the film on the floor. And he did that, and he was brilliant. The best first I've ever worked with, you know.
So how did you two become producing partners then in Thin Man Films?
Well, during the 80s, I mean, I actually got him in on something I was doing because I wasn't too comfortable with the producer he'd got, so he became joint producer. And then he did that on High Hopes, which was our first feature, and then we decided to form our own company. That's when people were forming independent companies, because Channel 4 had started.
Right.
And we decided that we weren't going to work for somebody else. We should form our own company and do our own thing, really. And that's over 20 years ago, and we've done all those movies ever since. And I mean, I just can't imagine what my life would have been like without Simon. I mean, quite honestly, I think it would have been very different and not half as fruitful, really.
Yeah,
he was an amazing guy. He had a long battle with cancer, and he'd been incredibly brave and, you know, kept going, but finally he had to give in.
He was such a sort of funny, fun man to be around as well. That energy was that rubbed off, I think.
Absolutely. And of course, you know, he was responsible for other significant films, not least amongst which is The Constant Gardener. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is a real chat. Which I was, you know, when he came out with that, I thought it was such a change of pace from the work that he was doing with you.
Yeah, but he's done other sorts of things over the years. I mean, he's had this other, you know, he's Because in a way, I mean, his stuff with me is a very specific thing to do with my take on the world. But he, you know, he was healthily eclectic and was happy to sort of get involved with all kinds of projects if he thought they were, you know, worthwhile.
Right? Yeah, you've been very kind, Mike, and just taking time out from, I know you're shooting on the set of your untitled 09.
Well, I'm not actually shooting on the set. We're actually in the very early stages of rehearsing it. We don't start shooting till the middle of the summer.
All right, well, we wish you the best of luck with it. Obviously, Simon won't be producing on this project.
No, but he got it going, and he will be credited as a producer, and it is therefore our last film together.
Right, so you're very keen to mark that out, and he knows before anyone else what it is, or he knows as much as anyone about
absolutely.
What it is.
Absolutely. We did all meet together and say it will be a film for Simon, and it will be a film for Simon.
Well, absolutely, and I'm sure if current forms anything to go by, Mike, you'll do him complete justice as well. So my commiserations with you, because I know you've lost a very great friend, as has the whole British film industry, in Simon Channing Williams. Thanks very much for joining
me. Thank you, Jason. Thank you.
Mike Lee there talking about the death of his good friend Simon Channing Williams. Zan Brooks joins me now to look at the week's releases. Welcome back, Zan. Nice to see you.
Hi, Jason. Nice to see you.
We've got three decent films to examine this week, Zan, to have a real good look at. We're going to talk about In the Loop, which we've mentioned many times here on Film Weekly. We're going to do I Love You, Man, and then we're going to do Good. So I hope that is good, because I like to do good every now and then, especially in film.
You are the ultimate radio do-gooder, aren't you?
Thank you very much. That's very kind of you. Let's talk about In the Loop, because we've been featuring it here since Armando Iannucci went to Sundance. This is the political satire, kind of the thick of it, which is such a good comedy on BBC Four, kind of made into a movie. It's kind of like they used to do with Are You Being Served, when they all get up and they go abroad. Here's the thick of it, going to Washington. Or am I being a little unkind on
Armando? Are you being a little unkind? That's not one to put on the poster, is it? If you like the big movie of Are You Being Served, you'll love In the Loop.
But there is a kind of
there's a tradition, isn't there?
There is a kind of TV to big screen transfer.
Yeah, and on the buses.
And let's face it, it's a lot better than lesbian vampire killers.
It's a lot better than that, but just as evil in its way.
Right, so what? I mean, so basically, we've got Armando Iannucci directing and writing. We've got Peter Capaldi playing the I'm not Alistair Campbell at all, but I'm a spin doctor in the government. We've got Tom Hollander as the MP who's been sent to Washington. We've got, who else? We've got Chris Addison as Toby. He's the kind of private secretary. Gina McKee is the communications director, and basically they're all being forced to go to war.
Well, war is basically unforeseeable, isn't it?
That's not our line. Walk the fucking line. Look, we've got Cannon Clark over from Washington today.
Okay.
We've got enough fucking Pentagon goons here to stage a fucking coup d'etat.
Minister?
Not the time, love. I'm busy. Fuck off.
This is Toby.
Toby, hi. Glad you could make it. Yes. It's a bit of an odd morning here.
Yes,
so welcome to the madhouse. I apologise for Malcolm.
Don't apologise for me. Apologise for yourself. Did I not just tell you to fuck off and yet you're still here?
It's true, I am, yes, still here.
Hey, fetus boy, lesson one. I tell you to fuck off, what do you do?
F off?
You'll go far. Well, fuck off.
Right.
Zan, as you can hear, there's a lot of swearing in the loop. Is it any fucking good?
I think it's kind of brilliant. I'm not going to kind of get down on your level with this. We're going to keep it kind of erudite here. But I think this is really good. I mean, this is sort of an acid satire on the mismanagement of the war in Iraq, even though it's kind of very, very thinly veiled. And it is that kind of the old adage about history playing out as tragedy and then as farce, and this is the kind of farce, and yet it's a farce that's arriving very quickly after the actual fact. I mean, you know, it's only 6 years ago that all of this was playing out on the TV screens, and again we get that kind of that weird double speak, that those terrible kind of equivocations, the sort of pretzel logic, and just that awful kind of bureaucratic kind of lexicon that justifies a war crime, basically.
Absolutely. I mean, there's a sort of mounting horror involved in the satire here, which is why I really liked it as well. It is very funny, I have to say, just because hearing Scottish people swearing and bullying is absolutely very amusing. And Peter Capaldi does it brilliantly, I think, here. But there is something much more at play here, I think, which is why I think the film is a very, very fine piece of work.
I think so. I think it's a film, basically, that shows the kind of the management of war, that it's not the actual action of war, it's how we kind of are led towards it and how it becomes enabled. And it becomes enabled by basically kind of squeaky clean bureaucrats and civil servants and people in offices. And so you get this kind of huge rogues gallery of these very, very bright, very ambitious opportunists who are kind of in thrall to a wider evil, really.
Exactly, all trying to keep their place, all trying to just do their job so they don't get sacked and getting bullied from top to bottom.
But more than that, still kind of hoping to ascend the ladder without actually quite knowing what decision they should make, and absolutely completely cut loose from any sense of sort of personal morality.
Yeah, absolutely, so that they can just advance to the next step. Yeah. So you've got the little underling whose paper's being read out by the private secretary, and then who tries to get in the room, and then the Brits then going to Washington and trying to impress the Americans, being impressed by the fact that they're in
Motorcade,
or there's Capitol Hill, taking photographs on their mobile phone of themselves at Capitol Hill.
The sense that the best lack all conviction, which is a thing that I was really kind of aware of at the time, where you're thinking, there are decent people here, but they're not speaking out, or they're not making the right decisions. And, you know, maybe with the exception of someone like Robin Cook, they're not actually prepared to lay their career on the line. And that's perfectly summed up by the character of General Miller, who's a brilliant performance by James Gandolfini, who's the kind of Colin Powell figure.
Yeah.
He's the kind of the good soldier who knows the reality of war and is damned if he's going to let this war happen, and yet is a bit of a hollow man, and you're thinking maybe he's not going to, you know, be the hero that we're hoping that he's going to be.
Absolutely, and there's definite echoes of Claire Short as well, who said it was the residing issue,
Short famously said she you know, searched her conscience and came to the conclusion that the bravest thing to do was not to resign.
Exactly. And there's a lot of that saying, is the brave thing doing what you don't believe in? To Tom Hollander's kind of put upon. And I think he's the sort of in the thick of it, which I think is very funny in Half Hour globs on the telly. It doesn't have quite the heart that Tom Hollander gives this kind of put upon, very small man who's
he's the
quite
sort of
bright.
The pooterish figure in this, isn't he? Although there's also kind of weird shades of Tony Blair here. That it is that kind of that smiling, beaming, like me, like me, like me kind of urge. But actually not quite knowing what he's doing and just being led by the nose a lot of the time.
And saying that I didn't want to do this. This is the actual opposite of why I went into politics. And that's probably what Blair thought at some point when he went to declare war with President Bush. Brilliant, let's go and declare war on Iraq. It's probably not what Tony Blair went into it for.
Who knows? Who knows what went on in that mind and in those meetings?
There's a lovely serendipity about it as well coming out this week. Where there's talk of
the Damien McBride week.
And there's even the talk of Tom Hollander's character worried that he shouldn't watch porn films because they'll show up and has to be declared them on the members' registry.
This is one of the great timely films. I mean, it is a film that I think will be looked back on almost as a sort of a kind of historical document in 20, 30 years' time. It's the film that best captures the age that we've just emerged from and are perhaps still coloured by. It's very much going for the TV kind of docudrama feel. Everything looks a little bit kind of grubby, and the camera's joggling around, and it's determinedly kind of small scale, even though the actual what it's tackling is the largest issue of our time. And maybe that's going to throw people, but they should stick with it.
But in a way, I like that because I think politics isn't, whilst it's on a grand scale, and
it's played out on a grand scale, but this is the wings of it.
It happens in little rooms, doesn't it? Indeed, smoke filled rooms. That's In the Loop, which Zan and I give hearty thumbs ups to. And I'm delighted to say that Peter Capaldi, who plays Malcolm Tucker, joins me on the line now. Peter, welcome to Film Weekly. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for asking me.
I, you're actually a very polite young man, in fact, which
I
is nice to hear.
I've been very well brought up.
Exactly. I don't know what your marital situation or if you have a mother or parents, do they know how foul-mouthed your character Malcolm Tucker is?
Well, it's really a shame. I brought my mother to a screening in Glasgow. In fact, Amanda brought his mother as well. And they all sat down the front. And I'm sure they were very proud. Well, I know my mother was very proud to see her son on the screen, but I'm sure she would have preferred, you know, that I was in Four Weddings and a Funeral or something, instead of this foul-mouthed beast who was screaming all over the screen. But she was still, she said she liked it.
So John Hannah, why couldn't you be like that nice John
why
Hannah?
Why couldn't you be like that nice John Hannah? Look what I gave birth to. You know? But at least it's still showbiz, isn't it?
Absolutely. It is a terrific performance, Peter.
Just
talks about the creation of Malcolm Tucker, because obviously it started on the thick of it in television. We get to see more of him, which is what I like, more monstrous version of him in the film In the Loop. Is it something that Amanda and you kind of created together, or did you just see it on the page and think this is how it's to be played?
Well, really, it's a sort of combination of all of those elements. I mean, ultimately, it's Amanda and the writers who come up with the plots and with the lines. So I try to inhabit those as interestingly as I can. And often, you know, it's a very plot-driven show, a plot-driven film. So it's quite hard to kind of infuse it with a kind of emotional side to it, which is kind of my job. I've got to try and make it look as if this is, in some way, shape, or form, a real person. Mm. But to answer the question, I guess, you know, the writers really come up with most of the concept of the character, but we flesh it out. And I guess it's evolved as well. I mean, because I've been playing him for 4 years, and there are other aspects of him that you perhaps don't see so much in the film, which in the earlier versions of the show, he used to be sort of much more Machiavellian and darker.
He was more Machiavellian than the man pulling the strings and making war happen at the UN.
Yes, but what I mean was he was more kind of secretively manipulative.
Right.
As opposed to vocally, bullying people. But now he does both. I'd never really played a part where someone was so aggressive and so verbally aggressive. And I had to try and think in my head, who did I know in my own life that was actually like that? And to be honest, the only people I came up with were American producers and agents. for instance, the Weinsteins,
yeah. You
know, were, are very like that. They're very kind of verbose and aggressive, but funny. You know, very, very witty, but tough guys, you know, who use a lot of street language and are able to come in the next day as if the bollocking they gave you yesterday never happened.
Yeah.
So I sort of drew on a lot of my experience of those guys.
Yeah, you must be delighted that this week, of all weeks, the film's actually being released. I know it's been a long sort of promotional haul since Sundance and Glasgow and Dublin and all that, but now it's coming released in Damien McBride week, in the week of, just week after Jackie Smith's husband and his worrying about porn. Do you think that's just happenstance, or do you think that the film is actually so chock full of those kind of relevances that it's always going to be a week where something pertains in the film to real life?
I don't know. I think it's absolutely uncanny. I mean, all this Damien McBride stuff is so kind of Tucker-esque and so kind of the language that he uses is so similar to Tucker as well. I think Amanda must have a crystal ball somewhere, you know, where he sees these things about to happen. Or perhaps it's what it is probably is that, you know, the culture of politics that we think is there is not the one that's there. We think the one that's there is the one that the newspapers tell us or the media tells us, but there's a secret one, which is between the politicians, their spin doctors, and the media, you know, which they all collude in. And that's the sort of area that we are trying to uncover and play around in.
Yeah.
And I think that's always there and always has been. And probably always will be, no matter what they say.
Well, I think we've seen it in films that, that say Neil LaBute did when he did the films about the offices, like In the Company of Men.
Yeah.
Then it's actually about offices. It's actually the interplay of human beings. And I think probably Ricky Gervais's Office did it as well.
That's right, all
we're talking about are people who are actually in a workplace. It just happens to make the world turn around.
Absolutely, yeah. And their little days when they have, you know, a hangover or when they're not very happy, unfortunately, have a consequence in world events, particularly in the loop.
We famously in this paper had Alistair Campbell writing that he found the film, I think he said it was boring, basically.
That's right, yeah.
Do you care? I mean, I can't. I was watching it again, sort of. I've seen it first, and then I read Alistair Campbell's own review, and then I thought, well, he must be insane. It's anything but boring, this film.
Yeah.
Why do you think it was that he was kind of put off by your portrayal of someone who may be similar to him?
Well, I think he probably wants to distance himself from the idea that politics and politicians are venal, you know, that they are bad guys, as it were, because, I mean, Malcolm sort of comes across as a bad guy. I don't think he's a bad guy. I think he does his job, which is defending, you know, the policies and intentions of a democratically elected government, you know, by which he's prepared to do that by any means.
Mm.
But so I don't think he would think he was evil. So I think probably Alistair doesn't want to be seen in a poor light, but it's maybe a bit too late for that.
Well, Peter, we're very lucky on Film Weekly that you've managed to take time and join us today. I know that the film's coming out. Wish you the best of luck with this monster of a man that you've created. long may he reign.
Thank you very much.
But long may he kind of stay in the shadows and not be too real. I hope maybe you've changed the dark arts of spin doctoring forever, and they're all going to be charming and lovely from now on.
Yes, well, that's when the most frightening, I'm afraid.
Peter Capaldi, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you, Jason. Thanks.
Zan, let's talk about I Love You Man now. This is a bromantic comedy. See what I've done there?
It's not the you that's done that. That's been
is
coined.
That Variety?
I think it's Variety.
I think they called it a bromance.
You steal everything from Variety.
I do. I think this will be a boffo film. if I don't
Who
ankle.
Helmed it?
I think, I don't know, no one helmed this film, I don't think. No, someone I'd never heard of helmed this film. It's about Paul Rudd, who's about to get married to Rashida Jones, and that's all going very well, when he realises he hasn't really got a best man, because he's very friendly with ladies, but can't sort of form male friendships. So he starts dating men in order to find himself a best friend.
Peter always connected better with women.
You know, I can see that, because he's a great boyfriend.
Thank you, fiancé.
Also, you got to understand, Zoe, Peter matured sexually at a very early age. I remember taking him swimming when he was 12 years old. Kid had a bush like a 40-year-old Serbian.
Oh, come on. Okay. Dad, please stop talking.
Good to know.
Nice.
Come on. He had a Speedo full of Brillo.
Oh.
Be proud.
who invited the stand-up comedian over here?
Zoe, here's the deal. Peter's always been a girlfriend guy. He put all his focus and energy into his relationships, and all his dude friends just fell by the wayside.
Zoe, don't listen to him, all right? I mean, we're 8 years apart. Barely grew up together in the same house.
This is ridiculous. Why is it weird that I had girlfriends?
Nothing. We're just saying you never really had a best friend is all.
Well, who's your best friend?
Your brother, Robbie.
What's up?
He's about the coolest guy I know.
Son. This is a twist on the normal romantic comedy, obviously. But it's also a twist on one of those oafish kind of Wedding Crashers buddy comedies, I thought.
Yes, I think it is. I think I'm a kind of sucker for the bromance, as you coin it. You know, I really like Superbad.
Yeah,
Superbad was fantastic.
That's a bromance.
That's a total bromance, and that's the ultimate bromance. This is a kind of a lesser spotted bromance, I think. It's not one of the vintage ones.
So you quite liked it?
I did quite like it.
Yeah, me too. I quite liked it. I laughed quite a lot, which is it's a comedy, so that I actually laughed quite a lot at sort of various odd times.
Yeah, I think it's actually very, very schematic. Once you kind of realise that the twist is the relationship between the two men, and the fiancé is kind of almost ballast, really. Once you realise that, it's actually very, very schematic and predictable. And yet I thought the performances were great. Rudd as the sort of the sort of, you know, the lady boy kind of real estate agent who, you know, has female friends but can't quite relate and is trying to kind of talk macho.
He's very sweet.
He's kind of sweet.
I think because he's part of that Judd Apatow lot and that kind of Seth Rogen kind of course. He's in the 40-Year-Old Virgin. He's in the Ron Burgundy film, The Anchorman as well. And I've always thought he's sort of the nicest one out of all of those kind of men horsing around.
He's the sort of the everyman, isn't he? He's the one that we can relate to. But I also thought Jason Segel was very good as the sort of the slackerish dude, Sydney, who
kind of
pals up with.
Now, we've seen him in
Forgetting Sarah Marshall
with Russell Brand and some other women. See, I thought it was really quite sort of slightly strange and amusing. And I did love most of these ones that I don't love, like last week's 17 Again, I really didn't laugh. This one sort of came along and tickled me.
This is funny. And it's well played. And, you know, it's not going to change the world. It's not in the loop, but it's kind of... passes the time
absolutely
very
it
nicely.
It does pass the time. Dude von Dudenstein.
This is our life, isn't it? Should we go on holiday together, Jason?
Yeah, Brosef Goebbels. Bro Montana. That's what I liked.
This almost a kind of an example of the kind of the death of the indie film in America. Because I think kind of 10 years ago, this would have been made as a straight indie film. But it would have been a much more low budget and probably taken a few more risks. Whereas this is a kind of DreamWorks production. It's quite glossy. It's quite contrived and schematic. And yet it has those little kind of pockets of ambiguity still there.
Absolutely. That's I Love You Man. Zan, let's move on to our final film of the selection of reviews. It's called Good. It stars Viggo Mortensen and Jason Isaacs. Viggo Mortensen plays an author in 1930s Germany whose new book is taken up as a paragon by the ruling party. And Viggo Mortensen gradually finds himself sucked into the politics of the time.
That's nothing.
No, really. Come on. You can tell Uncle Morris.
They've made me head of department.
That is fantastic. Congratulations.
Yeah.
Thought you said there was no way they promote you unless you... Well, not you too, Johnny.
Well, it's just...
Tell me it was pure self-interest. That I can understand. Please, don't tell me you agree with them.
It doesn't matter if I agree with them. The fact is they're in power. At least I'm doing something. I mean, if we want to change anything, steer them in the right direction, we can't stay sitting on the sidelines.
We? I don't think I'll be steering anyone in the right direction because I don't actually get a vote anymore. In case you haven't noticed, I'm not a citizen. Actually, legally, I'm not a full human being, so I'm stuck on the sidelines. What are you going to do? Give them a list of edifying books to read?
Look, if you're really so pessimistic, why don't you go abroad for a year or two until things settle down? There are many countries where you could practice. You've no ties here.
No ties. I was born here. I fought for this country. I am as German as you. How dare you? Why should I leave? That's exactly what those bastards want. Sorry. You bastards.
Zan, this is a film adaptation of a stage play, which I never saw.
I never saw it
by C.P. Taylor. It seems to betray its stage roots to me as a film.
Yes, it does. Apparently the stage play is very good. This feels both kind of stiff and oddly bloodless, I think. It's a sort of interesting companion piece, this, to In the Loop, in that it is a film about bureaucratic evil and about the little compromises that people make, and, you know, the road to hell is sort of paved by these little little compromises. And yet, yeah, it's a kind of... I think the form actually dictates it and drags it down. It's a film about little defeats and a kind of dying fall. And maybe that's true. The Viggo Mortensen character compromises and compromises and compromises and then is sort of lost. But because of that, it kind of lacks a little dramatic oomph, really.
Yes, it does. It seemed to sort of go along and make good symbolic points. I mean, there's a brilliant scene where he suddenly realises he's full evil and he's dressed in the kind of SS uniform. I suppose that's the big reveal of the film. But it sort of it takes a big leap to get there. And I think film would do it subtler. Maybe on the stage it works better in these incremental scenes when the lights go down and the scenes shift. You kind of feel the movement.
Yes,
I think
maybe.
A cut on film doesn't do the same thing.
Maybe not. And there's a couple of sort of very odd stylistic choices which are maybe carried over from the stage play, where he sort of sees road crews and then eventually kind of, you know, Holocaust victims singing Mahler songs, and he kind of stands there and gulps at them, and there's this weird sort of magic realist dollops that are sort of dropped in that don't quite work.
There's a bit where Viggo just gets kind of, you know, so wakes up one morning and finds out, oh, I'm a fully blown Nazi.
Yeah, and I'm sure that is by and large how it happens. Nobody consciously thinks of themselves as evil, do they?
Come on, stupid. Don't be stupid, be a smarty, come and join the Nazi party.
Well, it's, you know, that slogan might have worked for me if I'd been growing up in the 1930s in Berlin. You know, I hesitate to say, let's hope not, but we don't know.
You said that this reminded slightly, there was a companion piece to In the Loop. It seems a companion piece to me to the Boy in the Striped Pyjamas as well.
Yeah.
Interesting, both films, neither film use German accents at all. They all speak in English.
Yeah, they all speak in English, and they both end up, you know, with the main character kind of confronted by the full horror of the death camps. That worked better for me, Boy in the Striped Pyjamas, I think.
Yeah,
I think that packed a real punch at the end, whereas this just kind of went out with a whimper.
Yeah, it does have a decent scene. There's the Kristallnacht kind of build-up where you suddenly really feel for Jason Isaacs' character.
But Jason Isaacs' character was such a stock character.
Exactly.
He was the sort of the conscience, the kind of the earthy man, the priapic sort of psychiatrist, you know, from the age of Freud. You know, and Jason Isaacs did it okay, but it wasn't great. And Viggo Mortensen, again, is an actor that I really like. I really like him. And I think that this was a sort of stretch for him, but it's a very difficult role to bring off because he's a weak man, and yet one that we're supposed to feel kind of real empathy and identification with. And I kind of didn't. I just found him a sort of a milksop, really.
Yeah, there's that scene where he gives him cheesecake, and he says, Epstein's cheesecake. Yes, how are you going to get it if you lock up all the Jews? And it's like, well, as I say, the symbolism of stage, I just think sometimes just doesn't work on film, and people are too reverential when adapting it, that definite kind of correlatives on stage don't work as symbols on
it's
film.
A minor key film about evil and about the kind of the horror of evil, and yet the horror of evil didn't really come through enough for me.
Good or
middling, they should have called it.
It opens it up to itself. We'll be hearing from Viggo Mortensen shortly, but not while Zan's in the room. Zan, thank you for joining me again this week.
Thanks, Jason.
And if you want to keep up with everything that Zan's got to say, and of course his real review, go to the Guardian website every Friday, www.guardian.co.uk/film. Actor, poet, painter, musician, Viggo Mortensen became world famous with the success of his warrior, Aragorn, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy. More recently, he found critical acclaim with two dark collaborations with David Cronenberg, The History of Violence and the London set Eastern Promises, in which he played a Russian gangster. In his new film Good, Viggo plays a bookish professor in 1930s Germany, a man unwillingly and unwittingly swept up in the politics of the time. I met up with Viggo and I asked him if, after the Oscar-nominated Eastern Promises, he was looking for a change of pace.
I wasn't consciously looking to change gears that much, but no, it was just that I liked the story, it came my way, and as luck would have it, it was a story I'd seen, you know, 25 years before. I saw Alan Howard play the role in the original production of C.B. Taylor's Good, the play, and I was, you know, blown away by Alan Howard in particular. But the whole production, you know, even though it was about a certain historical period, you know, and sort of an abstraction of that period, but it seemed very pertinent. It seemed very immediate. I related it as much to the time I was living in as to, you know, Nazi-era Germany. Right. That was the value of the story.
And I suppose that's what we do now, again, try and relate it again to 25 years later. These things have a time difference, but I suppose they have a different resonance, don't they? I mean, as you say, you related it to those.
Yeah, but still, I mean, you know, the thing that's universal about it, and I think that what sets it apart, what makes it not just and that one more Nazi-era movie, which there have been many of, and there's several this year, is that it's more personal. It's, in some sense, not really about Germans or Germany. It's about something that we can all relate to, which is what happens when circumstances or people we know, sometimes usually people who are quite close to us, somehow inform us by word or by action, that we're on the wrong path, that we've strayed, you know, from our better intentions without even realizing it.
Let's go back to, you mentioned the effect that Good had 25 years ago and that there are a lot of Nazi stories on now. Now, I was thinking that when you initially saw Good, I think Nazis in the cinema, at least, were still baddies. They were still, it was Schindler's List, I think, was probably the Nazi film of those 25 years ago. It was a clear line between good and evil. Mm-hmm. The Nazi films at the moment that you mentioned, that there are a few this year, Good being, definitely being one of them, and let's say The Reader being another, and there are several other tales of that, even Valkyrie, I suppose, at the moment in a big budget. Yeah. They seem to be seeking out
humanizing the
Germans. Now, sometimes...
Well, there's an important difference, though. I would say that almost all other movies in the genre, you know, Nazi era or Holocaust related, they all hew to the convention that's well established, several conventions in the genre, which is there must be a catharsis at the end. Yeah. There is some extraordinary event, you know, some heroic, come to your senses, do the right thing finally, even if you get shot for your troubles. Or the villain, the real villainous aspect of somebody is finally unmasked, something, some revelation. There is no catharsis in our movie. There is none. There is no. It's not a movie about extraordinary people or extraordinary events. The end is not so much an explosion as an implosion. And because it doesn't have that, it's uncomfortable. It's different. Because it doesn't have catharsis, it doesn't let people off the hook.
No.
There isn't even at least a thin veil there, a distance. Oh, well, that's then, and this is now, and we're not like them, and I'm not like that. This doesn't allow you that safety.
The other
convention is, by the way, is the way we speak. You know, I heard there's that standard way of speaking in this movie that flies, you know, the convention even in The Reader, Schindler's List, it's a high, if you're speaking English, it must be some hodgepodge of Germanic accents. And why?
Yeah.
And the problem with that, even though it's a convention, a tradition that's mostly unquestioned, except for a movie like ours, that doesn't employ that device. The problem with it, that device, is that you are at least in part, even if the accents are done well, paying attention to how people are saying things rather than just to what they're saying, what's happening.
Now, I enjoyed that aspect of Good very much, but I still feel uncomfortable with all of the current trend. I don't know if this is my weakness,
the
humanizing. It is interesting, I think, from the perspective.
Well, in the end, Halder I wouldn't say he's a heroic character. He's a coward.
Yeah.
He's a moral coward He's reprehensible, and in some way he stands in for a vast majority of the German adult population at the time. Mm. So I don't, you know, I've heard a couple people say, well, that's, you know, it's, I don't like the fact that they make a Nazi be a good person. It's like, they're human beings.
Yeah. And he wasn't a good person. I mean, the title, good, is shot through with irony, one assumes.
Well, of course, if it was going to be a really obvious movie, you know, by a more or less subtle director, let's say, it would be good in quotation marks or with a question mark or dot, dot, dot or something.
Yeah. Vigo, an absolute pleasure to see you. Congratulations on your performance. Again, in another tricky film that defies easy reading. As I said, I tremendously enjoyed Eastern Promises with you working here in London with a very international cast, a British cast as well. And British. So it was nice to see you with loads of Brits again. So welcome back.
It was an honour and a challenge.
Viggo Mortensen, star of Good, talking to me earlier. That's it for this edition of Film Weekly. My thanks to all my guests, to Viggo Mortensen, to Peter Capaldi, and of course to Zan Brooks. I'll be back next week with more from the world of film. But for now, from me, Jason Solomons, and my producer on this week's show, Peter Sale, it's goodbye.